Welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Success isn't a goal, it's a journey. I interview the most incredible humans to keep your mind optimized for growth. Welcome to the podcast. Today we have David Brown on the show, the CEO and founder of Techstars.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. It's very prestigious. I mean, just a lowly Techstars company. And nice to actually get to the top of the seas.
We're all lowly entrepreneurs until we do something that winds up being successful.
Hopefully, somehow all the work that you've done has put systems into place so that you can help me be successful. And it's nice to also get some time to talk to you about how you got to this position. So is there one piece of good advice that you sort of give to people who are trying to start a startup? Who you think could credibly make a difference? Or is it, you think it's just very random, you have to go to the right person for the right problem?
Think about the why on what you're doing, right? If you're doing it because you want to be rich, or if you're doing it because you think you want to not work very hard and have your own hours, you're probably not in it for the right reason, because certainly tremendous success is financial and otherwise, but it takes a long time to get there. And running a startup is not a 9-to-5 job. It's life consuming. And because of that, I think it's important that if you're going to make that plunge and do it, that you pick something that you're deeply obsessed with, a problem that is very important to you to solve. It doesn't have to be important to me. Doesn't have to be important to everybody, but it has to be really important to you, because I think that's probably the bigger predictor of success of anything that we've seen. You are so passionate, obsessed about the problem that you're solving, that'll help you get through all the ups and downs of startup life. It's easy to get through the ups, of course, but there are plenty of downs, and you have to care passionately about what you're doing in order to get through those valleys.
How do you actually make sure you work on something that you really are passionate about for the long term, and that you're not just being oh, it's great, but maybe secretly you're probably I will get rich?
I think the thing to overcome there, as entrepreneurs, we have happy years, which is we like to convince ourselves the market is huge. We like to convince ourselves that the opportunity is there, that it's going to be easy to create product, that customers will just come flowing in the door. And I think it's having those happy years is part of what makes certain people successful as entrepreneurs, because they don't fear failure quite as much as we should. But there are moments when you should take off the happy years, right? And force yourself to have a good, hard look in the mirror. And maybe that's a person in your life, a friend or a significant other, that almost sort of serves as the counterbalance to talk you out of it, if you will, to make sure that you're being real with yourself in that moment where you're making that really important life decision.
Yeah, it's a hard one. So how did you do that for yourself in terms of the first startups that you're doing with them?
Maybe I got lucky. Our first startup, I guess the good thing was we were working for a different startup and saw a problem. The startup was providing ambulance services using technology, and David and I were working on the technology piece, and we thought this technology could be used for other companies. We don't have to do it for our startup. We could sell it and it could be a software company. And we had many conversations over a long, long period of time to think about, do we want to go off on our own and sort of sell the software out in the marketplace and create our own business? And how would it work? Maybe the process of working through some of the details and not doing it over a weekend, but doing it bit by bit over time, forced us not to take some direction that was incorrect, but rather flesh it out a bit more before pulling the trigger.
Yeah, I think that certainly for first time founders, it can be a hard one to go from just normally working to just running a startup. It's nice to kind of date ideas or kind of do it part time. But at some point you do have to go full time. But it's how can you kind of validate and de-risk? I really don't think that I'm the riskiest person, even though people look at my life story and go you're a nutter. But I don't really feel most of the things I've done were really that bad, or I had that much to lose from doing it kind of thing.
Well, nobody ever does, right? It's always the non-nutters that look at you and say, I couldn't lead my life that way. But I don't think any entrepreneur is unwilling to take risk. It'd be pretty rare.
So do you think you were kind of born with that kind of attitude?
I think of being entrepreneurial as something you're born with. I think of it as a gene. And I think that you discover it at some point in life. You may not know that you're an entrepreneur. And I think there's lots of stories. Look, on one end of the spectrum, you have people that sort of have that lemonade stand at age 6 and paper route or whatever, early on, that were sort of, in retrospect, you look back and you say they were a born entrepreneur. I don't think that was me. I sort of discovered it in college, having that summer job. I think others discover it later in life. There are people that are in their 30s or 40s that have worked in corporate jobs that then go out and become entrepreneurs. And then Colonel Sanders famously started Kentucky Fried Chicken at the age of 65 when he got a pension check and discovered he couldn't live on that. And so there are great stories of entrepreneurs that sort of bring that out from inside them at various points in life. But I think if you don't have that gene, if you're not born with that gene, there are people like that as well. And that's a great thing because we need people like that. But I don't think you can just take any person and teach them how to become an entrepreneur.
Yeah. Just wondering if like, do you have other experiences that you didn't like? And so it kind of made you want to go into being more risky?
Well, sure. You can be in a corporate job, right? And you can discover that you really hate how they are unwilling to take risk. But it doesn't make you more risky. It just makes you identify that that is an important thing to you, the desire and willingness to take risk as part of who you are.
So I know you have quite like a story about like moving to US. So was that like for college?
I mean, it's a good example of risk, right? Like I was working for a startup in Montreal in Canada where I was born and raised. I thought I was going to live there the rest of my life. And one day I was on a business trip in Florida working with a different startup there. And the guy's like, hey, come join me, right? Would you be willing to leave that Montreal-based startup and come work for me? And I literally said yes on the spot. I knew it was right. The events that were happening back home were perfect. The lease was up on my apartment. My friends had moved away. I had just broken up with my girlfriend. And I said yes. And I got on a plane and I flew home to Canada and I packed up everything I owned in my car to drive 2 days that it would take me to drive down to Florida. And the story was, and so literally I took the job on Thursday and I was going to drive on Sunday, but on Saturday, I had a wedding of a friend of mine. And so before starting the drive, I stopped at the wedding. And during the wedding, my car got stolen with everything I owned in it. And so my adventure moving to the United States and going to work for that startup was a complete fresh start, right? I came out of that church or whatever it was and found out that the only thing I owned in my life were the clothes that I was wearing. And I went to Gap and got some t-shirts and jeans and got on an airplane instead of driving down and started a new life. And it's an entrepreneurial story because, you know, stuff happens to you and you roll with it and you make the best of it. And it was a fun adventure.
How did that feel in the moment? Was it like, this is awful? Was it kind of like, actually, this is kind of cool. I get to start my life again. Or,
well, it's funny because I tell a founder story at a lot of the accelerator programs. And one time when I told that story, somebody said, oh, you're such an optimistic person, right? To sort of view that as a fresh start. And my response was, I think it was about 35 years ago. And when I came out of that church in the moment, when I saw my car with all my belongings were gone, I'm sure the first words out of my mouth weren't, what a great opportunity for a fresh start. You have this, oh, this is not great. But like, I don't have a memory of that. I just have a memory of just getting some jeans and a t-shirt going on with the adventure.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Like often like the really bad moments are actually really good. But in the moment of it feeling bad, you sort of can't recognize that. And later you're like, oh, this was sort of how I got to the really awesome thing.
Yeah, well, look, failure is the most common version of that, right? Where nobody in the moment thinks failure is a good thing, but it is true what they say, that you can learn more from failure than you can from success. And in retrospect, you can be happy that you had that failure, but in the moment, pretty unlikely that you're going to be happy about whatever that failure was.
So when things go really badly wrong, I'm sort of like in the moment being like, something great's going to happen and I don't even know what it is. So I just start getting excited, which you should probably start thinking a bit more about like how you maybe are going to fix the problem yourself. But like, I'm usually like, it's going to be fine. This is great.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely helps to have a glass half full on a view on life, right? Where even adversity, you figure out how to turn it into opportunity.
And you can kind of not get too caught up with your emotions of the bad thing happening and kind of be grateful. But I mean, it's probably not good to like make bad things happen to yourself, obviously. But I do find like they're usually the moments that turn into good stuff.
There's no beating yourself over the head with a stick just because it feels better when you stop.
Have you had any other like major failures that turned out to be like really useful for you?
Yeah, I mean, I had a failed startup, right, in 2004 to 2006 that I worked on with David for a couple of years. And, you know, we gave it a go. We invested our own money. We lost all our money. We lost 2.5 years of our lives sort of working on it. But, you know, I'd say the lesson I learned in that experience was humility, right? Because we were so sure we'd had a really successful startup. We'd had a successful exit. We sort of thought it was easy. And honestly, we developed a little bit of arrogance. And to have a failed startup and to knock some humility into us, I can't imagine anything being more useful in retrospect. But there was no way that I was thinking in the moment of that failure, oh, thank God I've learned how to be humble because I'm a loser. But in retrospect, I wouldn't trade that experience for the world.
That's useful. Do you ever worry about that with like textiles founders? If they've kind of had like, so far they've been successful and then you get them on textiles and like, and everything goes really well, that they then become a bit like deluded with their own success?
It's something that hopefully we help coach and mentor on, right? Because I think founders that are deluded with their own success that then develop a big ego are unlikely, paradoxically, to then continue to be successful. Sort of assholes don't win, right? And there are a few CEOs that you hear about running big companies that have a terrible reputation of being dictatorial, but they're few and far between. If you don't treat people well and you don't have the humility to recognize your own failings, I think it's very unlikely that you're going to be successful. Those types of CEOs, often they don't wind up being successful.
Yeah, I think in the long run.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And now an advert for all of you Mac users out there. Clean My Mac X is an all-in-one utility that takes care of your Mac's health. It's a macOS cleaner, a performance monitor, a malware remover, and occasionally a lifesaver. It's a perfect tool to prepare your Mac for the new macOS Big Sur by retrieving the necessary disk space and just keeping your software up to date. It's really easy to identify gigabytes of hidden junk and data and just remove it from your Mac so you keep space going. And it frees up RAM so you can keep performance and maintain all your scripts. And it's just super useful. I used it on my old Mac, which I managed to keep running for 7 years, just mainly because I use Clean My Mac to stop it from just overfilling with crap. And it also helps clean all of your apps if you delete them, that it just has lots of data attributed to them. And like, if you just delete it yourself, it won't actually recognize that. So Clean My Mac does a good job of that. And malware, as we know, no one likes that. Potential threats, it just gets notified to you and you don't have to worry about antivirus so much. And so to optimize your system and run your Mac at peak performance, just use Clean My Mac. And you can do that with a discount at macpaw.app/growth, where you can get Clean My Mac X with 5% off. That's macpaw.app/growth.
Okay, so in terms of getting Techstars off the ground, like, how did you go from let's just like help other startups and put this thing together as a bit of an idea to running the first one, getting people to invest in it, getting the startups going, like everything? It seems like quite a big step.
With most successful companies, it's sort of the standard line is it took me 10 years to be an overnight success. You know, the way Techstar started was David and me in 2006 saying, let's pay it forward and help some other entrepreneurs be successful. And let's run an experiment for 3 months in Boulder, Colorado in the summer of 2007. We opened up applications. We got 300 companies to apply. We picked 10. We found some mentors to help. And the grand vision then was, let's try to help these 10 companies. And if it's really, really successful, maybe we'll do it again next year. And that's what we did, right? We ran the first accelerator in the summer of 2007. It turned out to be successful. We got a lot of attention. We did it again in 2008, and it wasn't any different. It was just 10 more companies, but we fine-tuned the process a bit. We changed how mentorship worked. We attracted maybe some more people. We improved on Demo Day, and that was 2008. And then we said, oh, that's great. Let's do it again in 2009. And we just did it in Boulder in 2009. And it was by then that we started getting sort of the pull to, hey, could we do the same thing in Seattle? Right? And Boston. And we had some people there that were trying to convince us to do it. And, you know, 2009, 2010, we tried to figure out, well, let's see if we can do a second one. And that took a little while. It wasn't until 2013 that we first left the United States and decided to have a program in London. And that brought with it its own set of challenges. And so you sort of build muscle, you get good at sort of the basics, and then you build from there rather than just suddenly trying to do everything worldwide poorly. And that was very important to us, to sort of build slowly, make sure we were doing it well. We have a core value that is quality before quantity. And we were relentlessly focused on how can we provide a really great quality experience for the founders before we get to doing it again in greater quantity.
Well, firstly, like, how did you convince people that this was a good idea and get them to invest? Or did you not actually have investment for the first years?
So the original investment was just for 1 year, and it was David's money and my money. And we set out to get two other co-founders, which were Brad Feld and Jared Polis. And we each put in, you know, $60,000 roughly times four, $240,000, which was the cost of running the first program for a year. It was a lower investment amount at that time into the companies. It's $120,000 today, but it was $18,000 back then, or it was actually $6,000 per founder, up to a maximum of three. So $6,000, $12,000, or $18,000 was the investment amount. And we funded that ourselves for the first number of years until we then figured out how to set up venture funds, LPs, and things like that. I mean, venture, it's a 7 or 10 year game, right? But your actions today will yield results 7 or 10 years from now.
What do you think was the hardest thing during the first year? Like, what were the big mistakes that you made?
That's a really good question. I don't think we had diversity in mind. Like, in retrospect, we were four white male founders. And, you know, not that we created a sort of typical bro experience, but I do think that we could have benefited from having more diversity and being more inclusive of more folks early on. It wasn't on our mind, but I think when you start early, it's easier to bake into your culture over the long run. So if I could go back and change something, maybe that would be it.
Were that kind of the difficult things, like, in the actual process? Or it's not like after week one, you're like, oh crap, we haven't realized the diversity, or maybe you did.
The first year we had a number of mentors, and we had every mentor, every company equally. Now we have this notion of lead mentor, right? Where there's a subset of mentors that work specifically with each company. And we only did that the first year. And then we discovered the process that we use now, which is the mentor madness and, you know, the double opt-in and matchmaking to be able to have lead mentor relationships. But that's an example of a thing that we didn't know until we tried. And I would say there were probably 100 little things like that, little and big, right? That you tune the knobs. And that's why it took us 3 years before we decided to expand out of Boulder, because you want to fine tune the knobs a bit and get it right before you start to clone the system.
That's interesting. What do you think, if you take us back to, like, what was the moment when you stopped and were like, damn, I think I'm going to be doing this for a long time because this is awesome?
Well, for me, it was 2013. Honestly, like, the longer story is, David, we founded it together. I helped out, but I also went back to the previous startup that we had sold and I had left and went back and sort of took over running that because they were having some issues. And it wasn't until 2013 or 2012 or so that Techstars started to have 5 or 6 locations and actually had a number of employees and was really starting to scale. And that's when I sort of came back full time to really help the thing grow and take off.
Nice. And similar vein, that, what do you think was the best moment of the first year?
I think the attention that it got, right? Like, somehow this accelerator notion, that word didn't even exist. You know, we got good coverage in TechCrunch back when Michael Arrington wrote every TechCrunch article himself. We got a lot of interest from people like Fred Wilson and Eric Ries, you know, saying, wow, that's a really interesting thing that you have going on there in Boulder. Let me come out and visit and see what's going on. And I think that was validation, right, that we were onto something.
Did many of the first cohort go on to do really well?
Yes. In fact, one of the reasons Techstars was successful was we had an early exit from one of the companies that sold to AOL at the time, which got even more attention and got us going for the second program. One of those companies is still in business and doing very, very well. And many of the others over the years have had various exits, and many of the founders that were part of those companies then went on and did other great things. So lots of fond memories from that first program.
This is going to be a difficult question. Who would you say has been, like, your most impressive founder of all of the founders that you've, like, met and worked with?
Yeah, I mean, like, who's your favorite child kind of question. And so I could name so many, but I'll just name Isaac Saldana from SendGrid, because he's one of the most humble, nice, genuine human beings you could ever imagine. And he came into Techstars in the first couple of years. And of course, SendGrid went on to become a $1 billion company and ultimately sold to Twilio for $2 billion, $3 billion, something like that. So, you know, incredible success story, but couldn't be happier for Isaac and his co-founders, Jose and Tim. Like, they were just really great, genuine human beings. Very impressive.
Cool. So what do you think were the qualities that maybe helped him?
Well, like, it's a great story, right? Because we were talking about it earlier about being obsessed. He was obsessed with email going into spam, and he'd talk with acronyms and canned spam and whatever email protocols. In fact, the company wasn't called SendGrid when they applied to Techstars. They were called SMTP API, you know, incredibly nerdy name. And it just drove him nuts that every software job he ever got, he had to recode the forgot password thing to be able to make sure that the email that generated and sent out didn't go to somebody's spam folder, and thought that there should be a service that does this for everyone. And it was just angry, right? Almost at how there wasn't a solution for this problem, and was obsessed with solving it, and spoke in words that I didn't even understand. But you could just feel that passion and that obsession. And I think that's the quality that wound up making him successful, in addition to being a lovely human being.
Okay. Then what qualities do you think you've learned from running Techstars?
The world is a big place and there's lots of different people. And I think that most of my experience prior to Techstars had been more US focused, or North American focused at least. And I think that understanding different cultures, understanding different norms, running a global business is so much more than just time zone and language. It really takes a much deeper understanding about all of us as human beings and how we're the same and how we're different. And recognizing and leaning into those differences is something that's positive for everyone.
Yeah. So had you not traveled a lot then before?
I travel 200,000 miles every year.
That's a lot.
A lot of miles. It's enough to get to the moon.
Jeez Louise. Been a bit of a different year this year then.
That's right. Yeah. It's been very strange for me to be home so much.
Yeah. Do you think you, now that it's been possible to not travel so much, that you will do less, or are you kind of looking forward to actually being able to beat everyone again? And it's certainly awesome to have had you like visit the London cohort, that kind of stuff.
I love the travel part, and I love the face-to-face part of working with founders and being in a program and the energy of a demo day. And personally, me, David Brown, I don't mind those travel levels. I do think business and travel in general is going to become less necessary and will be reduced.
Yeah, it's a funny one at the moment, like thinking about how we're raising funding and if we need to actually be in London, if we're never actually going to be meeting any of the VCs that we're raising from.
And that's right. And VCs are getting used to funding a company with only a Zoom call. And I think they're also realizing that it is more efficient for them. They get to spend more time with their families. They get to travel less. Even if travel is just to the local coffee shop to meet a founder, they can be more effective with their time by investing through Zoom. So I do expect that will become a new norm that will persist beyond coronavirus and lockdown.
I mean, it was handy whilst the Techstars office was open to, one, it was just amazing to like get to know all the founders and things. And then, but being in London, like I was able to kind of go for a walk each Sunday with one of the mentors or investor or something, and still get like a bit of personal time, although like the day-to-day wouldn't happen. But now that we're in lockdown again, we've kind of taken the whole team to Cornwall, and we've just got like a big house by the beach, and it's like, okay, I went for a run on the beach this morning, that was nice. And I'm literally at the edge of Britain, like as far as you can into the Atlantic, and it's kind of nicer than being in London, but there's no VCs nearby, which kind of...
Yeah, but if you're going to do a Zoom call anyway, what does it matter? So I think you're right to take advantage of the fact that you're in lockdown to get some advantages of being near the beach or a bigger house or whatever the case may be.
Definitely. It's certainly great for the team and stuff in terms of getting to know each other a lot better, and just like all exactly. The things that like they're trying to get hold of me for help on, but I'm like running around being a useless CEO that isn't available enough of the time, but just those small moments, like I can always help. So that is super helpful. But yeah, it's an interesting one. And like what we do as a business long-term, like do we stick to kind of just going and working for the next year whilst we're not too big a team of like, okay, let's just go to Spain for a month and like live by the beach there and fun stuff or office. And
I suspect those things will be much easier post coronavirus than pre.
Definitely. What about in terms of if you were, if a kind of weird magic wand and sort of turned you into like a 30-year-old person thinking about starting a business again, applying to Techstars, what do you think you would want to run as a business? What else are you obsessed with that you'd want to change? And what would your application be?
I don't know, because I'm not the idea guy, right? David Cohen and my co-founder relationship was always the idea guy. You know, in addition to that, it's not on my mind because I love what I do at Techstars and I expect this is all I'm going to do for the rest of my career. Having said that, you know, my advice to a 30-year-old founder, not my 30-year-old self, but a 30-year-old founder, is look around the world because the world is changing. whether it's the rise of home grocery delivery or the decline of business travel, think about which things in the world have changed and which of those things that have changed are going to snap back to the way they were and which ones are going to live on forever. And the ones that are going to live on forever are things that are changing now and will live forever, probably have an opportunity around them where something that what didn't used to be necessary has now become incredibly necessary. And that sounds like a great opportunity to me to start a new business.
Cool. Oh, that wasn't quite the answer I was expecting, but it does lead into it.
What were you expecting?
I kind of just thought maybe you're obsessed with some other things. I wasn't expecting like a specific answer as such, but more like, okay, actually I am a bit annoyed about like climate change, and I've always been obsessed with like these kind of ideas. But does unpack like the whole dynamic of like co-founders and finding the right people that you can work with and stuff, because I've always been like the ideas guy to the point where it's like almost a problem because I have too many ideas and I kind of need to like shut them off and make sure like I kind of have the focus. But like finding people like you to work with is obviously useful if you can kind of can be focused and like execute on stuff and be a useful human. Like, do you think there's no real recipe to it? It's just people just gravitate towards people that they kind of work well with?
Yeah, I think finding a co-founder is much like finding a significant other. You find, you know, you get to know somebody, you gravitate towards somebody that you work well with. And often there's a reason they say opposites attract from a co-founder perspective. That often means there's sort of the dreamer idea person and there's the execution person. And those are very complementary skill sets. Maybe it's the technical person and the business person, hustle and the muscle. But I think it is important to find somebody that is both at the same time complementary, you know, fills in the gaps, but also is somebody that you really want to spend a lot of time
with. Yeah, I guess the age old finding someone that completes you.
That's correct. That's exactly right.
It kind of makes sense for our startup, like sort of the ideas person, but can take a long time to make decisions and things because I'm just sort of having to do my ideas and my business partner's like, doesn't really have ideas as such, just sort of just does. And then like, yeah, but it works really well.
And there's nothing wrong with that, because what you don't want is founders that are like constantly having ideas and nobody's actually delivering on any of them. I think it was Edison who said, ideas without execution is another idea for mirage.
So I've had a few friends that I'm like really good mates with, and then we're like, yeah, we should start a business together. But I'm actually like, what would we do? As in, we'd both sit around having ideas and like, yeah. So I think I've got it right this time. Okay. So in terms of when you're screening companies to join Techstars, what do you think is the most interesting question that you ask them? And if it does relate to the fact that you want to see that they're obsessed, how do you recognize that?
So the criteria we use, and it's only half a joke, is team, market progress idea. And so the principles there is that team is so important that it takes up the first three slots. Of course, it matters. Is there a big market for this thing? That's the fourth slot, right? Can they execute and get something done? That's the fifth slot. And idea, of course, is important, but it's sort of deliberately last to point out that the other things are. In terms of the team, you can think of it as a number of different factors, right? How well they get along, how obsessed they are. And, you know, that's a big part of the interview process of going through Techstars. Can we get conviction that these founders were put on earth to solve this problem? Because that makes it an easy yes if they are.
I guess before we go on to a different tangent or anything, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you would like me to ask?
Who is going to be president?
You want me to ask you that, really? Okay, buddy.
No, I mean, I think, look, I'm happy to take the conversation anywhere you want to go. I don't think there's any particular question that I'm dying for you to ask. I'm just happy to answer whatever's on your mind.
Okay. So how have you handled life balance? Because that's like a really hard one for entrepreneurs. And like you're saying, when you're obsessed with the problem, like that's awesome and does lead you to be obsessive around your work habits and difficult for managing relationships, managing like your own health.
It's a good question. I feel like I've been successful. Family that I love and appears to love me. I've been married for 20 years. I have two teenagers. And I think the answer to the question is it evolves over time, right? I was an entrepreneur and worked at a startup all that time. And how I acted, let's say when my kids were first born or when I was first married, is very different than now when they're off in college. And I think whether that's you come home for dinner and make sure that you have a solid hour that is just pure family time without a phone, that I know a lot of people do that. Others say I have to be home by bedtime and put my child to bed. In my case, I tend to be more sort of weekends are family time and sacrosanct and I work hard during the week, or adding on vacations every year off the grid, where even if it's only for a week or two to sort of unplug, recharge the batteries and spend time with family. I think everybody needs to find their own blended harmony of work and life and recognize that it should evolve over time and that there's no one size fits all that works for every person or every relationship.
Cool. Still working that one out.
It's a lifelong effort and you should never give up.
Yeah. Do you do any kind of like retrospective on yourself and like meditation or kind of coaching on these things?
I mean, I try to be open, you know, with myself and my wife and try to have open conversation about what's working and what's not and be willing to change. It's not that I have a super secret meditation app that suddenly makes everything okay. It's really a matter of believing that it's priority and doing the work to figure it out. Like Brad Feld, his technique is they have a monthly or quarterly life dinner, right? Where he and his wife, like, they have a dinner and they just talk about their life. What are we doing, right? What's working, what's not? Where do we want to head towards? Like, let's talk about that. Let's not talk about anything else. I've never used that technique. It works for them. So, you know, my message is whatever, figure out what works for you and do it more often.
Okay. What's the kindest thing someone has done for you?
The kindest thing? That's a really good question. My head goes straight to my wife for letting me do this, right? Like, it's just, like, I think significant others of entrepreneurs are the real heroes in the world because we're crazy, we're obsessed, we're off running, working crazy hours, certainly for low pay for many years. And you just need somebody to believe in you and support you. And most of the time, that's somebody who may not even be an entrepreneur. And it's just sort of a leap of faith. And that's sort of the case in my life. And it's been incredibly gratifying that for 20 years now, I have a partner who just completely lets me be me.
That's amazing. Nice. How do you let her be her?
I mean, it goes both ways, right? And I think recognizing that she has needs that also evolve over time, whether it's about being a mother and raising children or finding her own identity outside of the children or the home and helping be a partner to brainstorm ideas and ways to make whatever those hopes and dreams are possible and being supportive of that, right? Whether that means, like, when the kids were little, just forcing yourself to put aside your work and take care of the kids so that she can have a girl's weekend and go have fun, whatever it takes, right? And that way you're truly partners in supporting each other.
What would you say is one of your earliest vivid memories in life? Bit of a tangent.
Getting my own bedroom and not having to share a bedroom with my brother.
How old were you at this point?
5, I think. I think I remember it vividly, although I've always talked about that as being my earliest memory. So maybe I've told the story so many times that I just remember the story more than I have the memory. But that's what I've always described as my earliest childhood memory.
You must have been pretty happy.
Oh, yeah. It was very, very exciting.
Cool. Okay.
All right. I'm going to have to run.
Yeah. Cool. I was going to say thanks a lot for being on the show. It's really a pleasure to interview you and learn about like the story of Techstars and yourself. Really interesting individual. So thank you and have a good meeting. Nice.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure. It's been fun. All right.
All right. Take it easy. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed the episode as much as I did. My goal for this podcast is to help make people happier and wiser. And I'm also working on a few other projects in the podcasting space to achieve the same thing. I run the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast with a friend where we read and discuss a great nonfiction book a week. Talk about things like philosophy, psychology, the economy, self-improvement, and business. Books such as The Black Swan, Anti-Fragile, Invisible Women, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's a great resource. Most recently, I've been building an app, Syncify. It's really to level up your podcast experience. You can connect with your friends in the app and listen to the same things. So you can listen live in real time with each other, or create shared playlists and catch up at your own pace. You learn so much more by discussing ideas with friends. It's really silly to listen alone. You can also discover and share brilliant episodes with ease without having to try and recommend podcasts in different apps and just it all getting lost and confused. So It's also good for combating isolation and mental health. I personally find social media quite antisocial, and I just don't find it easy to reach out to friends to chat for no real reason. But I do love doing things with other people, and listening to the same content means that I can naturally talk about the same things, and it just gives me that friend time without going out of my way. So I really hope that it can help you, and I just would love you to try out the beta version and help us build this. And obviously, do invite your friends. It's all about friends. Thanks for listening to the show. If you have any questions, please reach out to me through the website at growthmindsetpodcast.com. I do love talking to listeners. You can support us on Patreon or by leaving a review on iTunes or telling a friend about us. But mostly, keep learning and keep growing.